From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!, broadcasting from Stanford University, California.
The United States may launch a massive military invasion of Fallujah. This would be a very, very bloody and total assault.
As President Bush wins another 4 years, we'll speak with a former advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad about why Bush failed in Iraq. The condition of Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat remains unknown. We'll speak with a Palestinian and Israeli scholar about the implications of Yasser Arafat's death in the Middle East. And a ballot initiative to ease California's three strikes law fails to pass.
It would seem that after this past Tuesday, reforming the criminal justice system in California is almost impossible. But there are those of us involved in the criminal justice system who care about fairness and justice who will press on.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We are broadcasting from Stanford University in California. President Bush yesterday told reporters he saw his victory in the polls as a mandate to push through his conservative initiatives, including privatizing part of Social Security, limiting access to the courts in the name of tort reform, and revamping the tax code.
I earned capital in the campaign, political capital, and now I intend to spend it. It is my style. That's what happened in after the 2000 election. I earned some capital. I've earned capital in this election, and I'm going to spend it for what I told the people I'd spend it on, which is, you've heard the agenda, Social Security and tax reform, moving this economy forward, education, fighting and winning the war on terror.
Thursday's news conference was just the 16th of George W. Bush's presidency. At this point in their presidencies, Bill Clinton had held 42 news conferences, and Bush's father, George H.W. Bush, had held 83. There are conflicting reports about the condition of Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat. The Palestinian envoy to France said this morning Arafat is, quote, in a critical juncture between life and death. She said he is in a, quote, reversible coma and that he could or could not wake up. Reports remain sketchy after Israel's Channel 2 television reported Thursday Arafat was brain dead. Doctors at the French military hospital where he's being held have denied the rumors. We will have more on Yasser Arafat in just a few minutes. In Iraq, three British soldiers were killed yesterday by a suicide bomber in the deadliest attack on British forces in over a year. The dead troops were members of the Black Watch, a group of British soldiers who'd been moved at the request of the United States from the relatively safe Basra to Baghdad. The Guardian's reporting that the brother of one of the Black Watch soldiers killed yesterday expressed anger over the regiment's deployment. Craig Lowe said his brother, Private Paul Lowe, did not believe that the Black Watch should have been deployed in central Iraq and that his family was heartbroken over his death. The British troops were moved to Baghdad in order to free up more U.S. troops to take part in the forthcoming battle for Fallujah. The Knight Ridder News Agency is reporting Marines are now expecting the attack on Fallujah will result in the heaviest casualty levels on the U.S. military since the Vietnam War. Navy Commander Lock Noyes said the hospital near Fallujah is preparing to handle 25 severely injured soldiers a day, not counting walking wounded and the dead. The hospital has added two operating rooms, doubled its supplies, added a mortuary, and stocked up on blood reserves. In other Iraq news, the humanitarian group Doctors Without Borders announced Thursday it's pulling its staff out of Iraq due to the worsening security situation. Meanwhile, for the first time, U.S. soldiers have admitted they witnessed Iraqi looters taking deadly explosives from the Al-Qaha ammunition site 18 months ago. The Los Angeles Times reports a dozen U.S. troops were guarding the sprawling facility and could not stop the looting because they were outnumbered by the thieves. When the soldiers sent a message to Baghdad for assistance, they got no reply. Last month, the International Atomic Energy Agency reported about 380 tons of deadly explosives were taken from the site. The explosives are powerful enough to detonate a nuclear weapon. Two U.S. soldiers are facing murder charges for shooting dead an innocent Iraqi teenager. According to a report in the Los Angeles Times, the two soldiers said they first shot the teenager after they mistook him for an insurgent. The teenager was severely injured after the initial shots. Then the soldiers shot him again to, quote, put him out of his misery. U.S. military officials told the L.A. Times they could not identify the dead Iraqi boy because they did not collect information at the scene and had lost track of his body. The Justice Department has announced more than 700 people were arrested on immigration violations in recent months as part of a pre-election crackdown. The Justice Department has defended the crackdown, claiming it was needed to avert a terrorist attack from disrupting the election. None of the 700 arrested were tied to any terror plot. In election news, the group Black Box Voting has announced plans to conduct the largest Freedom of Information action in history in order to monitor how effective electronic voting machines worked on Election Day. The group has previously warned that the machines could be programmed in ways to actually alter voting results. The group is filing 3,000 Freedom of Information requests from individual counties and townships that use the electronic voting machines. They're seeking to obtain internal computer logs and other documents. This comes at a time when officials in North Carolina are admitting that 4,500 votes were lost in one county due to electronic voting machine problems. According to the Associated Press, officials were misinformed as to how many voters could be stored, how many votes could be stored on each machine. Meanwhile, the website VoteProtect.org is reporting more than 1,000 voters, or more than 1,100 voters, call their 1-800 number on Election Day to report problems with electronic voting machines or other voting technologies. This news from New Jersey. The National Guard announced Thursday that a National Guard F-16 fighter jet on a nighttime training mission accidentally fired 25 rounds of ammunition at a local elementary school in New Jersey. No one was reported injured in the incident that occurred at 11 p.m. The fighter pilot missed his target by 3.5 miles. A new medical study has concluded that the drug giant Merck should have pulled its Vioxx painkiller drug from the market 4 years ago, when researchers first revealed the drug raised the risk of heart attacks. Merck didn't pull the drug until 5 weeks ago. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration recently published a study estimating Vioxx could have caused about 28,000 heart attacks or deaths since it was approved in 1999.
Every morning I get up and I watch the war, watch the war. Done. Well, this is evident in the American way. You
must give and I shall take. I will tell you what is moral and what's just. Because I want, because I will, because I can. So will I, because I want, because I will, because I can.
Jonathan Bruck, War, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting from Stanford University in California. The Knight Ridder News Agency is reporting Marines are now expecting the attack on Fallujah will result in the heaviest casualty levels for the U.S. military since the Vietnam War. Navy Commander Lock Noyes said the hospital near Fallujah is preparing to handle 25 severely injured soldiers a day, not counting walking wounded and the dead. The hospital has added two operating rooms, doubled its supplies, added a mortuary, and stocked up on blood reserves. On Thursday, President Bush was asked at his news conference about Iraq.
Mr. President, American forces are gearing up for what appears to be a major offensive in Fallujah over the next several days. I'm wondering if you could tell us what the objective is, what the stakes are there for the United States, for the Iraqi people, and the Iraqi elections coming up in January.
In order for Iraq to be a free country, those who are trying to stop the elections and stop a free society from emerging must be defeated. And so Prime Minister Alawi and his government, which fully understands that, are working with our generals on the ground to do just that. We will work closely with the government. It's their government. It's their country. We're there at their invitation. And but I think there's a recognition that some of these people must be defeated. And so that's what they're thinking about. That's why you're hearing discussions about a potential action in Fallujah.
President Bush speaking at his news conference on Thursday. We're joined by Larry Diamond. He's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and co-director of the International Forum on Democratic Studies at the National Endowment for Democracy. He's a professor of political science here at Stanford University. From January to April 2004, he served as senior advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy.
Well, let's talk about, first, your reaction to the results of the election. You come from a Bush think tank, what many call the Hoover Institution.
Well, I think my principal reaction is that the new administration is facing a number of fateful choices on the Middle East peace process, with the prospect that Arafat may pass away very soon, and most on Iran, with the question of whether we're going to in some way strike its nuclear facilities, and most imminently in Iraq, where, as we've just heard, there's the prospect not just any day, but possibly any hour now, of the beginning of an American invasion of Fallujah, which personally I think would be a mistake.
Tell me what you think it's going to look like. What's going to happen in Fallujah?
Well, I can't say exactly what it will look like, but I think it's pretty well agreed that it's likely to be fairly bloody, even though there are now reports that the people we would most want to be going after, the al-Qaeda terrorists, the Zarqawi circle, have basically left Fallujah. They're not going to stay there and wait to be taken out by the United States military. What worries me, Amy, as we were talking about in our public symposium last night, is that there is an emerging political option that has surfaced in the last few days, where a number of the hardliners from the Sunnis, both secular and religious nationalists, have put forward an open letter stating conditions that are conditions we can talk about. They're not unreasonable, under which they would come and participate in the elections. So if we want, if what we want is successful elections, and those require all parts of the country to be included, and we want to try and end this Sunni boycott and get the people who have been hardliners to have an interest in playing the political and electoral game, it seems to me we ought to be pursuing the political path as far as it can go before we go down a path of really massive violence.
Why do you think President Bush is doing this?
I think the main reason why he's doing this is because there has been a devastating amount of terrorist violence in the country, car bombings and so on. All of the intelligence for some time has indicated that much of this has been organized by, particularly the worst car bombings, by this al-Zarqawi cell that was believed to be in Fallujah and recruiting external jihadists to serve as suicide bombers. So I think the Bush administration thinks, and interim Prime Minister Alawi in Iraq thinks, that by going in and sort of, quote, cleaning out, an antiseptic term for a very bloody assault, cleaning out Fallujah, that you can restore order there, it'll no longer be a safe haven for terrorism and maybe the car bombings and other acts of terrorism and violence will decline. But if they've already left and gone to other cities, then this raises questions about the fundamental strategy.
You wrote a very damning piece, very critical of the U.S. occupation of Iraq in the Foreign Affairs magazine, September-October edition. It was entitled, What Went Wrong in Iraq? You're from the Hoover Institution. It's where Condoleezza Rice was from. Do you have a direct line to the White House? And what was the
response? I was asked by Condoleezza Rice to go out there late last year. I think that's well known.
To Iraq.
To Iraq to advise on the political transition and on the building of democracy in Iraq, democracy now in Iraq. And so I had a direct line in terms of being asked to go out there and being able to offer my views from there and from here. I think that the Bush administration is not one that really welcomes criticism publicly or even really privately. And so I think if there was a direct line, it's probably not very active right now.
Do you feel pressure?
No, I don't feel any pressure at all.
What did you see in Iraq when you were in Baghdad? Did you conclude that the invasion and occupation were a failure?
Well, I was against going to war when we did in the way we did. I thought we should not have acted unilaterally, that there was no imminent threat to American national security. It's interesting, as you noted last night, that so many people who voted for Bush think there was a link between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. That link did not exist. There's no evidence that it did before the war, but the irony is it does now in the sense that an important, you know, kind of subsidiary of al-Qaeda has made Iraq a haven for its vicious terrorism. In terms of the occupation, I think that the fundamental failure is the way that the Bush Pentagon, the Rumsfeld Pentagon, went in without enough troops, without any kind of coherent plan to establish and win the peace. I think this was, you know, an act of monumental negligence, one of the most irresponsible exhibitions of poor planning in the recent history of American national security affairs. But once I got there, many of the mistakes had been made, and I think we continued to make mistakes, which I document there in terms of not really listening to or adequately engaging the Iraqi people and having a very, very centralized operation in Baghdad. But nevertheless, I also found that Iraqis really want to choose their own leaders. I think there's a great desire for these elections to happen in January, and a great beginning of mobilization on the part of Iraqi women, young people, and others who want to build democracy from the grassroots up.
Last night, we participated in something called the Aurora Forum at Stanford University, where you made a comparison. You talked about preparing for a road trip. Maybe you could share it with us here, how the Bush administration prepared for going to Iraq.
Well, the best analogy I can offer about the scale of responsibility that's at stake here for not having enough troops, not having enough armored Humvees, body armored, you know, to have troops in Iraq in these conditions without the adequate body armor that would stop the kinds of fire that they're receiving, I compare it to a person taking their car on the road, knowing that the brake linings had gone, having the car plow through a crosswalk and killing people. Now, in that circumstance, under the state of California, that is gross negligence and is a subject to felony prosecution as criminal negligence. There's no law against that kind of gross negligence. There's no criminal law against such gross negligence in our foreign or domestic policy. But in terms of the moral calculus and the, you know, scale of loss of life, which is the greater crime?
So do you think Donald Rumsfeld should be charged with felonies?
No, because there's no law against it. We can't have retrospective justice. But I do think he should be fired, and the entire Pentagon leadership should be changed. I think it is by now well documented that the Pentagon leadership deliberately swept aside all of the planning that had been done by the State Department in the Future of Iraq report, deliberately dismissed and marginalized virtually all the top officials of the United States Army, military and civilian, including the Secretary of the Army, Thomas White, when they were saying we needed several hundred thousand, 400,000 troops to secure the post-war order in Iraq. And this Pentagon leadership was so arrogant, so confident that we would be welcomed as liberators, that we would be able to quickly install our chosen leaders for the future of Iraq, such as Ahmed Chalabi, that they just dismissed it all as nonsense.
Larry Diamond, this is very powerful coming from you, working at the Hoover Institution. We hear this from others, actually in government as well, but peace activists. But for you to be at the prime Bush think tank in the country, for you who is was a senior advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad, is quite astounding.
Well, you know, in honesty, I should say two things. Number one, I'm not a Republican, and Condoleezza Rice knew that when she asked me to go out there. So I give her credit for reaching across certain divides to, you know, bring in the kind of expertise they thought was needed. But look, I think our loyalty has to be to the country and to the truth, not to any particular administration or partisan cause. And in this regard, I'm hardly the only one who might have been brought in or started from a conservative or whatever type of loyal, quote-unquote, perspective. And it wasn't really that that brought me in. But others, Republicans and conservatives, have been saying many of the things that I've been saying.
Well, at the Hoover Institution, what was the feeling around the election?
Well, what I would say is that many of the individual scholars at the Hoover Institution are perhaps more traditional conservatives. Not all of them. I think there was very strong support for President Bush at Hoover. But a number of them were troubled by the war, thought it was a mistake, and were very, very troubled by the way that the post-war was prosecuted.
Finally, in just a minute, we're going to speak with a Palestinian and Israeli scholar about Yasser Arafat. Also, Amira Haas will be joining us from the occupied territories. But you wrote in your piece, What Went Wrong in Iraq, deep local suspicions of U.S. motives combined with the memory of Western colonialism and resentment of the U.S. stance in the Israeli-Palestinian struggle to generate a massive lack of legitimacy for the occupation authority. How central is the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to how people feel, not only in Iraq, but around the region right now?
Well, I think, you know, the crisis in Iraq is so deep, the insecurity, the joblessness, the, you know, all of the problems of violence and so on, the hunger for normality, that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is not uppermost on people's minds in Iraq. But it's important in terms of the judgments they make about the overall stance of the United States, and it's hugely important in the rest of the region. I think there may be an opportunity emerging here with new Palestinian leadership to really restart the peace process. And I think the Bush administration needs to get serious about it. And one sign of seriousness would be to appoint a high-level Middle East peace negotiator to try and really seriously restart the process.
Larry Diamond, I want to thank you for being with us. Larry Diamond is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, professor of political science here at Stanford University, where we're broadcasting from, and has a piece in the current Foreign Affairs magazine called What Went Wrong in Iraq. When we come back, we'll talk about Yasser Arafat, and then we'll speak with the judge about the law in California around three strikes. Stay with us. Marcel Khalifa Renata here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org, as we pioneer the largest public media collaboration in the country, broadcasting on almost 300 radio and TV stations, on Pacifica stations, on NPR stations, public access TV stations, on PBS stations. In Northern California, we're now on KRCB, PBS, and on both satellite networks, on Dish Networks, Channel 9415, Free Speech TV, and 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375 Link TV. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about the conflicting reports about the condition of Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat, the Palestinian envoy to France said this morning Arafat is, quote, in a critical juncture between life and death, saying he's in a, quote, reversible coma and that he could or could not wake up. Reports remain sketchy after Israel's Channel 2 television reported Thursday Arafat was brain dead. Doctors at the French military hospital where he's being held have denied rumors. Arafat was taken into intensive care on Wednesday, but the exact nature of his illness has remained unclear. Several reports from French and international media outlets say his condition now is one of clinical death. An anonymous doctor told the Israeli newspaper Haaretz that Arafat was in a coma that he would not recover from. CNN has quoted U.S. officials as saying he is on life support. At a press conference Thursday, President Bush responded to reports that Arafat had died.
Soul. And my second reaction is that we will continue to work for a free Palestinian state that's at peace with Israel.
President Bush speaking at a news conference on Thursday. For three decades, the 75-year-old leader has been the symbol of Palestinian struggle against Israel for a state. He has never appointed a successor, and many are fearful his death could trigger a power vacuum and chaos. In the occupied territories, Palestinians were reportedly glued to radio and TV broadcasts. Palestinian officials in the West Bank city of Ramallah are said to be engaged in talks over a successor. Palestinian Prime Minister Ahmed Karai has reportedly been assigned some of Arafat's powers, making him the effective head of the Palestinian Authority. Mahmoud Abbas, the former Palestinian prime minister, is reported to have taken over the leadership of the Palestine Liberation Organization and Fatah. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has said he will allow Arafat to return to his headquarters in the West Bank town of Ramallah if he recovers. But he has made it clear he will not allow his adversary to be buried on the Temple Mount, also known as the Haram al-Sharif in occupied East Jerusalem. We first go to Ramallah, to Amira Haas of Haaretz, the newspaper. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Amira.
Hello. Hi.
Can you tell us what is happening now in Ramallah and what the latest news is of the condition of Yasser Arafat?
Well, as for the latest news, I think that you cited the latest news. We just as you are, we all are dependent on news which come from Paris, and sometimes these are conflicting news. But this is obvious that these are the last days of Yasser Arafat as a leader. Anyway, if he's going to make it or not, it's for doctors to say. I believe that Ramallah showed during the last week that it got used very quickly to the absence of Arafat. And you don't see great manifestations of sorrow, of grief, of people missing him. It's not to say that people are necessarily wait for him to die, but Arafat has lost a lot of his credibility and popularity during the last years. During the Intifada, during the years of Oslo. So people are not mourning him, and people have discovered very quickly since he came to the occupied territories, returned with the Oslo Agreement, that Arafat is mortal just like any other human being.
And right now, what kind of meetings are taking place? What kind of gatherings are taking place in Ramallah? This is the compound of Yasser Arafat.
I believe the political forces, mainly around Fatah and the Palestinian government, or so-called Palestinian government, and the Palestinian security forces organizations, are all meeting in order to make sure that institutions function well, that there are no clashes going on or will go on, and that there are enough security people to guarantee that there are no clashes between rivals, all sorts of rivals. But this is really, I mean, the last week has been quite quiet in the Palestinian internal arena. It's not that there have been Israeli attacks on Palestinians. But the Israeli predictions that Palestinians will start immediately when Arafat disappears, that Palestinians will start their internal fight against each other, has proven wrong. Hello?
Yes, we hear you fine.
Yeah. So, still, of course, the main... I think there is a lot of exaggeration. Concentrate so much on Arafat and how it might influence the future, because with Arafat or without Arafat, the main issue here is Israeli occupation and Israeli decision to continue with expansion of settlements and of colonies. This is the core issue, and all the rest is some sort of a footnote.
And the Prime Minister, General Ariel Sharon, saying that Yasser Arafat cannot be buried in Jerusalem, does that anger people?
You know, Palestinians are not allowed to go out of Gaza for studies, for medical treatment. Palestinian grandchildren cannot see their parents, their grandparents who live somewhere else in the occupied territories. I mean, to concentrate on this, of course he would not allow him. I mean, if he doesn't allow, if the Israeli authorities do not allow a woman with cancer to get out of Gaza, so why would they allow somebody to be buried in Jerusalem? We concentrate all the time on the symbolic things, and this has been one of the illnesses of the last 10, 12 years, that we replaced symbols to reality, to concrete facts, and there was a Palestinian airport, and everybody was so happy about the Palestinian airport, and everybody forgot that, after all, it's the Israelis who give the permit or do not give the permit to leave the airport or not. And there are so many others who cannot even dream about getting to an airport because they wouldn't even have the money to pay for a short drive between Gaza and Rafah. So I feel that we that this talk, this is kind of a spin to discuss symbols and external things rather than the reality of occupation. And the question of how Palestinians resist or fail to resist this occupation.
We're speaking to Amira Haas. She is an Israeli Jewish reporter for Haaretz, is the only one who has lived for years in the occupied territories from Gaza to the West Bank. She is speaking to us from Ramallah, which is the home of the Yasser Arafat compound. In our studio here at Stanford University, we're joined by Dr. Khalil Barhoum. He is professor and coordinator of African and Middle Eastern languages and literatures at Stanford University. He is the president of the Association of Arab American University Graduates. He is a Palestinian who was born in Bethlehem. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Your response to, right now, the reports of Yasser Arafat somewhere between life and death, they say, and what this means.
Well, Yasser Arafat has been on the Palestinian scene now for the past four decades. And like him or not, he does represent the Palestinian symbol for resistance and the embodiment of Palestinian nationalism. Now, his political legacy may be in doubt after his death, but his historical legacy, I think, will live on as a man who has dominated Palestinian, you know, politics and the political and military struggle, if you wish, for the past four decades. The thing about the internal struggle among Palestinians that some Israelis were predicting, I think, is overblown. There was a scenario where there may be some clashes between internal factions within Fatah, which is the leading movement, and the PLO, which was started by Yasser Arafat. There's no question that there is a conflict right now between the older generation, the old guards, represented by Arafat and Mahmoud Abbas and Ahmed Quraya. These are the two people now who are going to be taken over from Arafat if and when he dies. And the younger generation, the people who were born under Israeli occupation after 1967, 1967. And these people were represented mostly by figures like Marwan Barghouti, who's now in, you know, serving in Israeli jail a life term. The other aspect to Palestinian conflict that some Israeli analysts have been also fearing and kind of predicting is maybe a struggle between Fatah on the one hand and the other Palestinian factions, primarily Hamas and al-Jihad Islami. My prediction is that I agree with Amira Haas. I think all these predictions they serve the Israeli interests. And I honestly don't think that the Palestinians will have anything approaching civil war. There will be a political struggle for the soul of the PLO. There's no question that Mahmoud Abbas does not have the same clout or leverage that Yasser Arafat has wielded within the PLO. Nor does Ahmed Quraish Abu Ala, the current prime minister, have that kind of you know, influence within the ranks of Fatah. But when everything is you know, said and done, the PLO has to move on, and they have to put their house in order. And Arafat will remain, in my view, the tormentor of the Bush administration and the Israelis, even in death, just like he was in life. Because when he was still alive and very energetic, they declared him, you know, out of hand, irrelevant. Although they could not produce an alternative Palestinian leadership to this irrelevance of Arafat. Now, after his death, the onus actually falls on the Israelis and the Americans to push the so-called peace process, because now that the obstacle to peace, Arafat, is removed. So they have to produce something. And I'm afraid that the people who are going to take over from Arafat, as I said, are not going to be as malleable as Arafat, are not going to be as influential as Arafat in pushing any kind of peace agreement that the rank and file within the PLO and within the Fatah movement are not going to be happy with. Arafat had that clout. These people don't. So if the Israelis think that, you know, this impediment to peace is out of the way, and now we can push some kind of half-hearted, you know, half-cooked peace settlement on the Palestinians, and they have no choice but to take it, I think they're badly mistaken.
On CNN this morning, they were talking about Yasser Arafat having in banks something but hundreds of millions of dollars to billions of dollars, and that a struggle is going on now. They were speculating between Suha, his wife, and the Palestinian Authority over that money. What knowledge do you have, Dr. Barghouti, of this? Is any of this true?
I have no access to these accounts to begin with, and I'm just being facetious here. I don't think anyone in the PLO other than Arafat had access to them, and that in therein lies the secret of his, durability. That's the fact that he bought political allegiance over the years with money. And no one had control over these bank accounts except Arafat. And this was actually a great concern among the Palestinians and the Palestinian leadership, that if Arafat does not pass on these, you know, secrets to his finance minister or the people who are going to be taking over within the PLO, the money may end up in the Swiss banks for good. But these are the rumors. I mean, I'm not sure that anybody really has a grip on how much money, how many bank accounts, or whether this is actually the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Niamh Gordon is also on the line with us, Israeli professor at Ben-Gurion University from Berkeley. And very quickly, your response. Usually you're in Israel, now you're here in California.
Well, I think Israel now is at a juncture. I think Israel has created a myth in the past 4 years called the no-partner myth, that there is no one to speak with on the other side. It has portrayed Arafat as a terrorist, as a corrupt person, as an authoritarian ruler. And it has said that the peace process has collapsed because there's no one to talk with on the other side. And now that Arafat is going to pass away, and I agree with Amir Ahas that the days are numbered, Israel has to make a decision. It has to decide whether it wants to change its course and to address the real Palestinian claims, the Palestinian demands and grievances. Withdrawal to the 1967 borders, the establishment of a Palestinian capital in East Jerusalem, the recognition of the rights of the Palestinian refugees, or whether it wants to create an alternative myth, a new myth, one that would again divert the public's gaze from the real issues and enable Israel to continue expropriating Palestinian land and destroying the population's infrastructure of existence. Now, I believe that Prime Minister Sharon, will choose the latter option. And then the only question that now lies is what this new myth will be.
I'm going to give Professor Bachum the last word as we move into this weekend.
I agree with both Neve and Amira. The occupation remains the real issue. Since the beginning of the Palestinian struggle, the Israeli policy has been predicated on two pillars. One is the delegitimization of the Palestinian leadership, no matter which leadership emerges. And the second is the dehumanization of the Palestinian people. And in the process since 1967, what we've seen is a continuing and progressive kind of march toward the legitimization and normalization of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. The whole world now has come to realize that that's really the crux of the problem in the Middle East. It remains to be seen whether the Bush administration follows suit, whether they start realizing that and addressing it, or whether they continue to fall behind the Sharon right-wing policies in Israel for the term, as long as Bush is president. And that would be a real catastrophe, not just for the Palestinians, but I would dare say to the Israelis as well.
Well, Professor Khalil Bachum of Stanford University, Dr. Bachum, thank you for being with us. Also, President of the Association of Arab American University Graduates, Neve Gordon, Israeli Professor at Ben-Gurion University, speaking to us from Berkeley, and Amira Haas in Ramallah right now of Haaretz newspaper. When we come back to California to look at one of the bills that went down, one of the ballot initiatives in California. Of serious significance for criminal justice in this state and country. Stay with us. Marcel Khalife here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. We're broadcasting from Stanford University, Palo Alto, California. I'm Amy Goodman. Voters in California headed to the polls November 2nd to vote on one of the most crowded initiative ballots in the state's history. A $3 billion fund for stem cell research was passed, while an initiative to require businesses to provide workers with health insurance failed. Two measures that would have expanded gambling in the state failed, while a proposition expanding authorities' ability to collect DNA samples was approved. But none of these measures captured as much attention as Proposition 66, which sought to ease California's three strikes law. The initiative sought to limit invoking the three strikes law, which gives prison sentences of 25 years to life to those convicted only of violent or serious felonies. California is the only state in the country that applies extended sentences to any felony, leading to long sentences for hundreds of offenders for crimes like selling marijuana or shoplifting. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger was heavily opposed to the measure and reportedly spent about $2 million of his own campaign finances to fight it. This, according to the Los Angeles Times. On Election Day, Proposition 66 failed to pass with only 46.6% of the yes vote. We're joined right now by Judge Ladoris Cordell. She's a retired Superior Court judge who spent 19 years on the bench in Santa Clara County. This year, she was elected to the Palo Alto City Council, and she is vice provost here at Stanford University. Welcome to Democracy
Thank
Now!
Thank you, Amy. Good morning.
It's very good to have you with us. What happened? Explain the proposition and what happened.
Sure. This proposition, really the genesis for it, is the Three Strikes Law, which was enacted in 1994. And it was enacted two ways. It was passed by our California legislature, and it also became law by way of an initiative. And the initiative was really insurance to assure that there would be a two-thirds vote needed to overturn it or to change it. And over the 10 years that the Three Strikes Law has been in effect, there have been some dramatic changes and impact on the criminal justice scene in California. As you stated earlier, California is the only state of all the states, and there are 20 other states that have a three strikes law in effect, but we're the only one where the third strike, which can bring a sentence of 25 to life, can be a violent or nonviolent offense. And it is other states only have violent offenses as a third strike. So as a result, California has, under the three strikes law, we incarcerate four times the number of those in all of the other remaining three strike states combined. So we have 42,000 people serving time under the three strikes law in California, with a population we have of 35 million in the state. If you take the other 20 states with a combined population of 112 million, they incarcerate a total of about 10,200, four times the rate. And it turns out 7,000 people in California are serving life sentences under three strikes, 7,000. Of that number, 4,200 are serving life for where the third strike was a nonviolent offense.
Give us an example.
Oh, for example, I mean, there are so many, and it boggles the mind. People hear this and they say, this can't possibly be. Now, understand, these people, and I'm going to give you some of the third strike offenses, are serving life. And that's costing Californians about $31,000 a year per inmate. And this is at their age now. As they age, it'll cost $70,000 to $100,000 a year per inmate to maintain them.
$31,000 a year. How much does it cost to go to Stanford?
About $30,000. So I mean, that's exactly it. I'm glad you made the comparison. But let me answer your question. So we're talking about third strikes. For example, nonviolent, stealing a spare tire, possession of a stolen bicycle, shoplifting a $70 drill from Sears, shoplifting 21 packages of aspirin, possession of less than 2 grams of marijuana, shoplifting a tube of hair grease, shoplifting a package of AA batteries worth $2.69.
Okay, let's look at that. Shoplifting AA batteries. This was the third offense?
That's correct, the third strike. So because of that strike, the person who did this is now serving 25 to life, meaning the person had two violent felonies before this and then shoplifted the third time, and now they're out of here.
And so what was the strategy? What was the campaign? Weren't you winning before Election Day?
1 week before this election, the polls show that voters were favoring Proposition 66 by close to 70%. And in 1 week, There was a turnaround. And, you know, I shouldn't be surprised by it, and I think those of us now, when we look back at it, know that this was all about money and the media. The opposition, spearheaded by Governor Schwarzenegger, spearheaded by the Prisoners Guards Union, and also by one individual who was very wealthy, they put together $3 million and bought $3 million of airtime to promote a lie. And the biggest lie told in this, there were two, actually. One was that if this proposition passed, 26,000 or more felons were all of a sudden going to be turned loose on the streets. That's a lie. As I've told you, there are only 7,000 people serving life, and of that number, 4,200 are serving life for nonviolent offenses. So it's no near the 26,000. That was a scare tactic. The other tactic they used in commercials was to showcase victims of crimes, and all of them were white females. So they showed and tried to scare people to say, oh my God, all these felons are going to get loose by implication. People who are black and brown, and look who are victimized already, and these are people who are going to be victimized further. So it was a campaign based on racism, a campaign based on dollars and money, and they completely turned it around in 1 week. People, unfortunately, fell for the lies.
How had you organized? How had people organized before that?
Well, the organization was very, very good. There were many organizations that came together across political lines to pull this, to make this happen. And there were debates, the mailings throughout the state, and indeed, a very good grassroots effort. This was one of the few times that I've actually participated in recent years in a grassroots effort where communities, particularly communities of color, are very concerned about the impact that Three Strikes is having on black and brown communities. People all across the board came together. It's just that if you don't have the resources and the money to fight it, the big kind of money, this is what happens.
Where do you go from here, especially as we move into this new Bush administration?
Well, you know, it's very easy to become frustrated. And the day after the election, there were many of us who were very frustrated and downcast. But what it does, those of us who've been around long enough, and I've been around quite a while, is to say we need to regroup. We need to look at what happened and to learn from it. And one of the things that will likely happen is perhaps we need to look at Proposition 66 and readjust it and look at what we proposed and maybe take out some things, make it so that there are less areas that can be subject to attack. But it means we're going to regroup, and this grassroots effort will continue. An effort has been going on for 10 years, actually since the enactment of the Three Strikes Law, to try to reform it. And indeed, in California, we couldn't even get a bill passed to just study the effects of the Three Strikes Law. And that's why we turned to the initiatives. I'm not a great supporter of initiatives, quite frankly. I think that they've just kind of taken over the political landscape, especially in California. But in this case, efforts were made to try to change the law through the legislature. And as I said, we couldn't even get a study. So this is one where I think we were forced to go this route and reform the criminal justice system in California. Bottom line, it's political. It ends up always being political, and people begin to stop looking at the substance and begin looking just generally at, oh, you're trying to change the law and make it softer, which we're not. And so we're going to gear up again and fight it more.
Well, Judge Ladora Cordell, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Judge Cordell is vice provost here at Stanford University, and this year was elected to the Palo Alto City Council. That does it for today's program. A lot of people to thank, of course, our producers, remarkable team in New York, Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Ryan Abernathy, and Mike DeFilippo, our engineers. Here in Stanford, from the Aurora Forum, Diana Watt and Nicole Macbeth, Melissa McLeod, Christine Soldal, Mark Gonerman, and from Stanford Video, Gordon Gurley, Miguel Guzman, and Mark Whalen. Also, special thanks to Dennis Moynihan and Chuck Skurich. Tonight, I'll be at San Diego First Unitarian Church, opposite the UCSD Medical Center Hospital. And on Sunday, November 7th, at Eckerd College in St. Petersburg for the St. Petersburg Festival of Books as we continue our Exception to the Rulers tour at Foxhall at Eckerd College. You can go to our website to sign up for our daily digest headlines at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting from Stanford University. Thanks for joining us.